Hello, and welcome to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine's podcast series. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine is a monthly digest of original crime and mystery short stories. To give you a sense of what the magazine is about, we offer podcasts of our stories from our back issues. In this installment of our podcast series, we have R.T. Lawton reading his story, Across the Solween, from the November 2013 issue of the magazine. R.T. Lawton has been publishing stories with AHMM for the past 15 years, and he's a favorite among our readers and other writers. His stories range from humorous to historical, and have recently been collected for e-readers available at Amazon and Smashwords. Across the Solween introduces a new series featuring the urban, educated son of a drug warlord who must think fast to survive in the unfamiliar world of his father in the jungles of China.
He was late. For 2 days now, I had squatted back on my heels in the damp greenness of this mist-covered jungle slope, like any hill tribesman would, with my thighs resting on the back of my calf muscles and an old French rifle across my lap. The rest of my squad lay fanned out in concealment on the slope, smoking black market American cigarettes and digging in their packs for rice balls wrapped in banana leaves. But I could also hear occasional rustling in the brush and whispers of complaint as they grew restless. Pale dawn of this third morning broke swiftly over the mountain ridge behind us. A raucous chatter of birds and monkeys in early dawn died away with the growing light. On the opposite slope, a broken line of shadow slowly retreated toward us as the sun rose even higher over the ridge. Occupied with my own concerns, I missed the silent approach of my Mon scout until he murmured his broken Cantonese near my ear. "How much longer will you give, elder brother?" A good question, and I had no good answer. "Your father," he continued, "has wealthy customers waiting far south of the Thai border for this shipment." "Tell that to my half-brother, who is late. My orders were to meet him on this side of the Solween River and then provide security." The scout settled in about an arm's length away. "Then we will wait some more and hope he comes." Down at the village on the river bank far below us, thin columns of white smoke from cooking fires rose up from short red flames and rushed their way higher into overhead clouds of white mist drifting through the river valley. Several Cayenne ferrymen gathered around those fires were well aware of our presence, but had the sense of mind to pretend we weren't there. They too were waiting and knew Kang was overdue. Their job was to ferry the mules and their pack loads over from the far side of the river. Sticky balls of opium carried in those packs would be placed safely inside the hull of each wooden longboat, while the animals would be led far enough out into the water for the ferrymen to loop stout ropes around their thick necks and lash them to the sides of the boat. Each longboat had a small outboard motor to power it across the Solween, but at some point the mules would find themselves swimming in deep water as they were dragged along. I had once wondered how they felt when they were halfway from either side, yet had no choice in what was happening. "You are damned either way," murmured the old scout, as his wrinkled hands selected a slice of betel nut from a small pouch kept in a chest pocket of his unbuttoned fatigue shirt. A shirt crisscrossed with faded black and green tiger stripes from the Americans' war far to the southeast of us. The pouch was soon replaced in his chest pocket while the chosen piece of nut disappeared between his red-stained lips. He sucked on the sliver for a while before chewing. Then he paused absolutely still, as if in deep thought. Somehow this man's head, bare legs, and loincloth body seemed immune to the same insects that bit at my city-bred skin. He rocked forward. If elder brother is attacked by Ha Chinese, or maybe even those Burmese devils we are no longer friends with, your father will think you weak for not helping him. I nodded in agreement, even as I fanned the smoke from my filtered cigarette, using it as a bug repellent around my head. He was right, but there was another side to this. And if I cross the Salween and my half-brother is merely late because of a woman, as sometimes happen, then I have disobeyed my orders for no good cause. Now it was the scout's turn to nod. He spat on the ground in emphasis. No doubt my half-brother had a good excuse, at least in his own mind, for his lateness. No matter, Father would find his own excuse to be angry with both of us. Father did not like his mule trains to be delayed at this time of year. He had many dealings with powerful men who operated hidden factories to turn our sticky balls of sap from the potent moonflower into almost pure dragon powder. But in the end, when Father's anger had run its course, my half-brother would still be the favored one. I sometimes wondered if it was Kang's movie star good looks and daring escapades that bound my father to him, or was it that the mother of my half-brother was Shan, the same people that my warlord father controlled as his personal army? At least I was pure blood, not mongrel. My own mother was the daughter of a high-class Chinese family in Hong Kong, where my father had first met her. I suspect he paid an exorbitant price for her, and more important, the legitimate business connections that her family brought to the marriage. Father had originally come south out of Yunnan province as a young officer in the White Army, pushed out by Mao and his victorious Reds during the Civil War. But then an army, which no longer has a country, must find a way to feed itself. Opium became the answer. Soon he had much money to invest in properties and companies. In Hong Kong, he was well respected, if not necessarily considered respectable, in the higher social circles. He bought Mother a luxurious apartment in a tall building far up the slope of one of the hills overlooking Kowloon Harbor. Soon after, I came along as their only child. Mother and I seldom saw him, save once or twice a year, when business brought him in from the jungle. Life was good for us, and I grew up wanting for nothing. When I was of age, I even attended one of the British schools in the city and began my education as befitted a young gentleman. Then shortly after I turned 16, Mother died of a fever, and my whole world changed. On his next trip to Hong Kong, Father sold the apartment and took me back to his base camp in the Golden Triangle, where I was to learn his trade and earn my own living. My previous education scarce prepared me for this new existence, but now, as a sub-lieutenant in my warlord father's army, I had to make many decisions on what I was prepared to do in order to earn this new living of mine. As one of my teachers in the English school once lectured, man may not have chosen the circumstances he finds himself in, but he may then choose his own fate within those circumstances. Looked like this was to be one of those choosing times. Kang was at least a day later than usual. I reached over into the front shirt pocket of the old scout, withdrew his pouch of betel nut, and selected a small slice for myself to chew on. The stimulation power residing within this nut would be much needed for the long trail I was about to embark on. "We go," I said. The old rascal grinned back at me with his red-stained lips. At times like these, I often speculated that he knew me better than I knew myself. For a little man who had one day simply appeared out of the jungle and attached himself to me, he was now like a favored uncle, one with a slightly larcenous heart, if you happen to look close enough. But then I trusted him more than I did my own blood family. I rose to my feet, cradling the French rifle in the crook of my left arm. Several faces turned my way, and the men gradually grew still. When I had their attention, I motioned down the slope, then headed off toward the trail leading down to the Cayenne village. My Mon scout, with his American carbine slung across his back, slowly fell in close behind. Only once did I turn to look back, and that was to see Sergeant Lynn and his corporal hustling the squad into line and quickly following. As we entered the center of the village, all heads turned in our direction. Chickens with their black and red feathers scattered across the packed dirt. Pigs grunted at the intrusion and moved off into the underbrush. Only the headman stood up. The others stayed where they were squatting in a circle around their cooking fire. He offered hospitality, but I was in a hurry. We need to cross. I spoke the words, and my Mon scout translated into the Cayenne Sino-Tibetan language with its tonal sounds. The headman eyed my armed men and rubbed his hand along his chin. No doubt he was calculating the number of longboats that would be needed. After the two of them had passed many words back and forth, the scout turned back to me. He wants paid for the crossing. He will have to wait for his money. Tell him that we will pay on the return trip. Words passed again, and I could tell that the headman was not happy with this new development. He says he thought he would be paid for crossing several mules, their loads, and those men 2 days ago, but they have not come and he is not paid. Tell him I will take care of that. Tell him he has my word. To indicate that negotiations were at an end, I clicked off the safety of my old French rifle and stared at the headman. The village clearing grew silent, and none spoke. The only sounds came from the crackling cook fire where we had gathered. My Mon scout nonchalantly unslung his carbine and used the rifle barrel to gesture toward the longboats tied up at the river's edge. After a moment's hesitation, the headman barked orders at his men squatting near the fire. They leaped to their feet and moved quickly to the riverbank. I settled into the headman's longboat in a position directly behind him. With no loads to pack and no mules to tie and drag, we were swiftly across. Once on solid ground again, I ordered the men into a combat patrol and sent the scout out front. In the growing daylight, he would be my eyes and ears in this jungle thickness. Tracks of any passing mule train would be child's play for him to find and follow. But I also knew he was good at smelling out potential ambushes. It was about 4 hours later that we came upon the bodies. They were laying off to one side in an open space where a smaller path split off the main trail. I set my men into the tree line on both sides to take up defensive positions while the scout and I examined this killing ground. One body lay right at the junction, while four more were found further back along the trail. All had been shot more than once. Their weapons were gone. "These are Shan," muttered the old scout as he looked over the bodies. "I know them as some of Elder Brother's soldiers." I vaguely recognized at least one of them as being my half-brother's man. The other four I did not know. Father had been careful to place soldiers from the Shan army under Kang's command, while I was given Chinese troops from remnants of the old Kuomintang troops that Father had defeated after he changed sides, leaving the old White Army behind. Now there was only one side for Father, his own side. In this landscape, political alliances were fluid and ever-changing, according to one's present needs. Betrayal and treachery among the various opium warlords had become a way of life, a matter of survival. This blood is still fresh, whispered the scout. Maybe an hour or two ago. What do you think happened here? I inquired in a soft voice. The scout moved slowly back and forth along the trail, head down to study the ground. Occasionally he would stop to point out a few brass casings lying half concealed in the vegetation. These men were killed at close range, muttered the scout. They had no time to fight. Who ambushed them? I asked. That I cannot tell, he replied. As his eyes swept from side to side, searching the earth for signs of further disturbance, he appeared bothered by something I could not see. Did any of Kang's men escape? I saw no marks leading off into the jungle, replied the scout. Other than that, he seemed reticent to speak unless prodded. Then where did the survivors go? The old scout paused at the three-way junction and pointed at the offshoot trail. Hoof prints of mules and boot tracks of many men go this way. That is the way we will go then and find out who did this. But we must hurry if we are to catch up with them. I motioned Sergeant Lynn over to me, quickly explained the situation and our need for haste. He, in turn, ordered the men to abandon everything they carried except for weapons, ammo, and water. Any object that might make noise during our rapid movement was to be discarded or tied down. In short fashion, we moved at a dog trot along the offshoot trail, with my Mon scout far out front and the corporal in between us to silently relay any hand signals. After 3 hours of jogging, interspersed with regular intervals of fast hiking, I rounded a bend in the trail and came to a sudden halt. The corporal was hunkered down at the side of the trail, and my Mon scout was walking backwards toward us. I moved up and waited beside the corporal until my scout reached our position. His face looked troubled. There are several men in a clearing just over the next low-lying ridge, he whispered. Some are Shan, and some are our used-to-be friends. Burmese communist soldiers, I inquired. The old man nodded. How many? Many. And our mules with their loads? They are there. My half-brother? He is there, too. Then we must recapture the mules and save my half-brother from our enemies. The old scout gave me an odd look, but said nothing more. In my own mind, I was already celebrating my elevation of status in Father's eyes if I managed to pull off this coup to recover all our goods. I motioned a sergeant to me and instructed him to place our men on a firing line along the ridge. No one was to shoot until after I fired the first round, and then they were to be careful to shoot only at the Burmese. I wanted no Shan or mules to receive damage. He nodded and left to do as I had instructed. My Mon scout led me up to a good vantage point overlooking the clearing, while Sergeant Lin and his corporal placed our men into a firing line on both sides of me. From a pocket in my fatigue shirt, I removed a small pair of binoculars in order to get a more detailed view of happenings below. In the grass on the left side of the clearing, my half-brother's surviving men seemed to be at their ease, loitering and smoking cigarettes. On the back side of the open space, all of our mules, with their loads still intact, were being held by lead ropes in the hands of Burmese soldiers. One of their soldiers was checking the contents of a pack on one of our mules. Over to the right stood Kang in a red, loose-fitting collared shirt and striped Shan trousers. I could see an automatic pistol in the military holster at his waist. Across from him stood a Burmese communist with the rank of captain on his shirt. As I watched, the captain bent over to a metal box at his feet, withdrew a stack of money and began to count bills into my half-brother's hand. It was then that I realized what had been bothering my scout. I whispered quick words in his ear and sent him over the ridge and into the jungle toward the right of the clearing. He moved like the ghost of a tiger on the hunt. I gave him 3 minutes. Once more, I looked through my binoculars at the scene below. Kang and the captain seemed to be arguing about something. The money counting had stopped. As the second hand on my watch reached the end of 3 minutes, I aimed my rifle at the captain, held my breath, gradually let it out, and slowly squeezed the trigger until I felt the recoil. The captain spun and fell. 2 short seconds of stunned silence passed. Then chaos descended into the clearing with an ear-numbing roar. Sean and Burmese alike sprinted for the jungle. Mules brayed, kicked, broke free, and scattered in all directions, some running over soldiers not fast enough to get out of the way. My movie star good looks half-brother disappeared in the mass exodus. As our shooting became directed more off into the trees behind the fleeing men, I saw a blur of black and green tiger stripes streak into the clearing, scoop up the money box, and merge quickly back into the jungle. We kept firing until my Mon scout returned over the ridge. Then I gave the order to retreat. At a jog, we evacuated the area, leaving mass confusion behind. I put the corporal out as point man and had my Mon scout bring up the rear, eradicating any obvious tracks of our passing. 3 hours later, we arrived back at the main trail. Nothing had changed here. The 5 bodies still lay where we had found them. When my scout caught up, he was empty-handed except for his carbine, but I took a nod from him to mean that the box was close by. I motioned him and the sergeant over to me and away from the others. Just off the trail, I leaned my rifle against a nearby log, then reached into my scout's shirt pocket to get another slice of betel nut from his pouch. Placing the nut piece within my mouth, I began to chew, as if this were merely a social function amongst comrades. I stuck my right hand out to the sergeant. "Let me see your weapon for a moment." The sergeant's hesitation was barely perceptible, but he quickly presented his rifle. I accepted it with both hands, pushed the release lever with my right thumb, and caught the ejected magazine in my left hand. Cradling the rifle in my arms, I thumbed the 3 remaining rounds out of the magazine. The man should have reloaded after our one-sided firefight in case we had been ambushed by others during our return to the main trail. He and I would talk of this, but that was a matter for another time. "We have a peculiar situation before us, Sergeant," I began, "and I need to know where your loyalties lie." Sergeant Lynn's eyes flickered from mine to the scouts and back to me. I'm sure he realized the verbal minefield he had been placed in, and him now without a weapon. To my way of thinking, it was up to him to figure out where the safe path out was to be found. Acting as if all of this had nothing to do with himself, my Mon scout ducked his head slightly and turned sideways, which swung the tip of his rifle barrel in the general direction of the sergeant. Sergeant Lynn's eyes darted towards the carbine muzzle, and a light perspiration suddenly appeared on his upper lip. I could see him trying to figure out all the angles. He had once been a member of Chiang Kai-shek's White Army, which had turned to opium smuggling, and later been defeated by my warlord father. To survive, he had sworn fealty to my father's Shan army, and then been assigned to me. The path of his prior allegiance had many turns and breaks in it. In the end, he opted for the most direct final route and safety. "My loyalties lie with you," said Lieutenant. "I answer only to you." Good. I did not want him telling the story of today's events to my warlord father. I placed the magazine back into his rifle and tossed it to him. "You are wise in your answers. This should prove to be a profitable venture for you." Then I paused as if a sudden thought had occurred to me. "Tell me, do you trust all of your men, and will they follow your orders to the extreme?" I glanced pointedly at the 5 dead Shan by the trail. Sergeant Lynn followed my glance. Yes, sir, they will. Then tell your corporal to have these five bodies taken deep into the jungle and buried where no one will ever find them. No traces. We never saw them. Then report back to me. He saluted and left. After Sergeant Lynn was safely out of earshot, my Mon scout inquired in a low voice, "Do you trust our good sergeant?" "We will soon see," I replied. "He has no true love for my treacherous father, and if he decides to seize this opportunity to turn the men against me before the situation goes any further, he will quickly realize he is holding an empty weapon." I held up the three rounds I'd extracted from the sergeant's magazine and had not replaced. They then disappeared into my pocket. Once the man had proven himself trustworthy, I would inform him of this oversight on my part. "The money box is close by?" I inquired. The old scout nodded. "Good," I said, then turned to keep an eye on Sergeant Lynn and tell his corporal and the rest of the men begin carrying the dead Sean off into the jungle. On the surface, it appeared the man would show loyalty for now. What I had to do was cement our new relationship for the future. In the British school in Hong Kong, I related to my Mon scout, our teacher spoke of an Italian from long ago who claimed it was good for a leader to have his men love him, but as a last resort, it was better for a leader to be feared by his followers rather than loved. You and I have instilled fear into our sergeant, and I will rely upon him to instill it even deeper into the men. However, I plan to work it both ways by also giving them cause to love me. Sergeant Lynn finished his duties near the tree line and started back in our direction. "Bring me the box," I whispered. My Mon scout slipped into the jungle and was gone. "Sergeant Lynn," I said as he drew near, "here is our official story. My half-brother was late in arriving. Fearing for the safety of the convoy, we crossed the river and went 2 days up the trail, but saw nothing. We then returned to camp." "But what of your brother Kang, the mules, and the five dead Sean?" I showed my teeth in a smile. "The convoy was Kang's responsibility. He will have to come up with his own story for why he was selling father's opium to the Burmese instead of delivering it to buyers in Thailand. No doubt he will claim to have lost the shipment in an ambush. I speculate that Kang had those five shot by his own men because he did not trust them to keep their mouths shut." I quit smiling. "I assume there must be a lesson in there somewhere." It was not a hot time of day as evening approached, yet our good sergeant seemed to be suddenly sweating again. He opened his mouth as if about to say more, but must have felt the sudden presence of my Mon scout behind him and moved sideways to better see what was coming up on his blind side. The scout stepped around to my left and placed the box at my feet. I opened the lid and removed a bundle of Burmese currency, letting the sergeant see how much more was still in the box. His lower face betrayed no emotion, but his eyes grew almost round. "Distribute this money among the men when they return from their labor," I instructed, as I put the bundle in Sergeant Lynn's hands. "Explain to the men all I have told you, and let them know there will be more payments as long as no one causes trouble. Perhaps remind them how easy it was to dig a grave in this vast jungle for those dead Sean." I watched his face for signs of rebellion or treachery. There were none visible. "Night is not far off," I said, "and we need to be further along the trail, away from here. Get the men ready." "Yes, sir." He saluted more sharply than before and moved off at a fast pace. "Their loyalty for you grows with every passing minute," muttered the scout in a voice just above a whisper. I turned to him, but that red-lipped grin of his was difficult to read through. Go bury the box near this crossing and mark the place in your mind so we can retrieve it easily whenever needed. Then move ahead of us and erase all signs of the killings and Kang's convoy as having been on this trail. My Mon scout paused for a moment, money box in hand. What will happen to elder brother? I had the sudden urge to laugh the first time since mother's death. Father will be very angry with my half-brother, and it will take him a long time to get over the loss of the entire convoy and this year's profits. Obviously, Kang expected me to follow orders and stay on the other side of the river, not to come looking for him. Now his ways have gotten him into trouble. I would like to be there when Kang tells his story, especially since he tried to go into business for himself and has nothing left but his lies. In which case, I suspect our war with the Burmese communists will promptly be renewed with greater intensity. And what about us? If you mean the money, I replied, I assume you already helped yourself to some. His grin faded slightly. When I reached into your shirt pocket for some betel nut, I continued, I noticed that your other shirt pocket had a bulge in it that wasn't there earlier. His red lip grin suddenly grew wider than I had ever seen as he seemed to realize we knew each other well. And if you mean how will you and I come out, I expect to receive some heat from Father. But as long as no one here talks, then we are good. After all, we never found Kang and his convoy. Therefore, we had nothing to do with losing Father's good. It is a clever plan, said the scout. Do you think the gods a chance will favor us? We cast our lot when we crossed the river, I replied. After that, everything happened to fall into place as if it were meant to be. The old scout touched his shirt pocket, which did not contain his betel nut pouch, as if to reassure himself that money and the gods of luck were on his side. I also learned in that British school, I continued, of a Roman general who cast his own lot over 2,000 years ago when he took his army across the river. What became of this general? He became the ruler of all Rome. My Mon scout nodded and spat on the dirt before moving off into the tree line.
That was R.T. Lawton reading his story, Across the Salween, from the November 2013 issue of Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. We're published 10 times a year by Dell Magazines. You can find us on your newsstand, or electronic issues and subscriptions are available for e-readers and iPads. For more information, look for us on Facebook or at our website, themysteryplace.com. This podcast was produced with the help of Jackie Sherbo and Deanna McLafferty. I'm Linda Landrigan, editor of the magazine. Thanks for listening.